When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode of Into the Night was made possible by the unwavering support of our dedicated Patreon donors. Their generosity allows us to delve deeper into the mysteries that await us in the dark world of Five Nights at Freddy's. If you're captivated by the secrets we unveil and wish to be part of our journey, we invite you to explore our Patreon page. By becoming a patron, you not only gain exclusive access to bonus content, behind-the-scenes insights, and special perks, but you also play a vital role in sustaining the future of this podcast. Visit the link provided in the description below to learn more and join the Night Conclave. Hello, and welcome to Shadow Scrying, the official sister series of the Into the Night podcast. As always, I am your host, Nick. And thank you for listening. You know what the best thing in the world is? I don't know that either. But you know what's close to the next best thing in the world? Starting your own family, winning $1 million, or reaching retirement age when Social Security will still be available. They're all applicable options. Unfortunately, I don't know nor know how to acquire any of these things, which is why I spend so much time engrossed in between the pages of the world of Five Nights at Freddy's. Tonight, we are going to be tackling the entire Tales from the Pizzaplex series by one of my generation's slash algorithm's favorite pastimes, a tier list. We will be ranking the entire Tales novella collection in chronological order of release, and do a rapid-fire summary and analysis of each entry. We will be critiquing each novella on four different pillars of quality. First, was it an engaging read? This critique goes beyond simply asking, was it well written? The focus here is on the ability of the narrative to captivate you. Were the characters so well crafted that you wanted to learn more about them? Was the story concept intriguing? Did it resonate emotionally with you? Do you care about the character's fate? Was the narrative immersive, frightening, or filled with compelling drama? You know, the usual reasons why we read stuff. Second, is it rereadable? Is it a story you would want to revisit? Or is it more like most people's experience with the McRib, once and then never again? But you at least can say you've tried it. Are there small details or memorable moments that you would want to reread? Parts you can't wait to share with your friends, or passages that vividly come to life in your imagination. Third, how does it utilize the FNAF lore? This is a FNAF book, is it not? So does it make a good use of its connection to the franchise? Does it expand on the lore, explore concepts in new ways, or deepen existing characters and narratives? Moreover, does it do so without contradicting the game canon? Does it maintain the series continuity and enhance the experiences we love without overshadowing them? And fourth, and possibly the most pretentious, how is it on a metaphysical level? In other words, does it offer good symbolic storytelling? Does it convey deeper meanings or impart lessons? Does it reflect real-life themes or inspire readers to see the world differently? Even though it's a FNAF story, it can still provide inspiration, optimism, or profound insights despite being a horror tale. As for some final considerations, it's important to note that some stories are actually two-parters, and the epilogue stingers are 8 separate entries spread throughout the entire series. The two-parters in the Tales series include the B7 Tales, the Mimic Origin Stories, and the Bobby Dot Tales. To ensure a fair assessment of each story, we will review each one as an independent piece, except for the epilogues, which we will evaluate as a single collective bundle. Each novella will be ranked from S tier to F tier, and to give a brief rundown on each tier, S tier, count the W. Novellas in this tier are near perfect in every aspect. They are exceptionally well-written, memorable, and evoke strong emotions while reading. They fully utilize the FNAF lore to enrich the narrative and delve into deeper themes on a secondary level. These novellas set the standard for the best of the best, much like Count the Ways did for the Fazbear Fright series, or the Chili's Molten Lava Cake did for desserts. A tier, Freddy Faz Win. Novellas in this tier are tremendous and highly enjoyable, but they may have one or two minor flaws that prevent them from reaching S tier status. They exhibit strong storytelling and engage the reader effectively. They're similar in quality to Fazbear Fright tales like Into the Pit or To Be Beautiful. They set a high standard, although they may just fall that short of perfection. B tier. Great job! Novellas in this tier are above average and deliver a satisfying reading experience, particularly if you're a FNAF fan. They excel in at least two aspects of our pillars, but may fall short in the other two. While they may not reach the heights of a S or A tier novella, they are still enjoyable reads. These are the stories that are great for the FNAF enthusiast, but may be considered only above average for readers outside of fandom. C tier. Certificate of Meh. Novellas in this tier are lackluster entries into the FNAF franchise, offering a very average experience and a basic glimpse across all aspects of our critique. They fall short in measurements and may struggle to engage readers, even those familiar within the FNAF fandom. While diehard fans may push through, the average reader is going to find little to keep them invested. D tier, Sleepy Michael. Novellas in this tier are below average for all parties involved. They are boring and difficult to get through on the first read and nearly impossible to endure on a subsequent attempt. Similar to enduring a Rye Toast video, these novellas lack engagement and fail to leave a lasting impression on readers. Just kidding, of course. F tier, Security Bleach. Novellas in this tier are undeniably bad, to the point where they actually become spectacles to behold. Unlike D tier, where the story is so bad it's a slog to get through them, F tier novellas are so atrocious that they become strangely fascinating. You literally cannot believe you are reading this. Your mouth will be hung agape, and you will be hearing popping coming from your frontal lobe as you read because the last bit of your neurons are giving up on this world. Besides the fact that I should institute an obvious spoiler warning, if you haven't read the novellas and want to be immersed in them without being spoiled, do not watch this. Besides this, this is all the prayer we need to get through. Alright, let's start at the beginning with Book 1, Lally's Game. Book number 1, Lally's Game, serves as our first foray into the world of the Tales series, and it seems that you all enjoyed it. On Spotify, for every Shadow Scrying episode where we covered a Tales book, we also conducted a poll allowing our amazing, beautiful, and incredibly talented listeners to vote on where they believed the books ranked within our tiers. Overall, Lally's Game appeared to be a favorite, with a close to 75% three-way split between ranking it as an S, A, or B tier. And I could see why. The novellas within this collection make it a top 3 book to pick up for those getting into FNAF's literature side of the franchise. Frailty. Let's start with Frailty, probably the second most controversial novella in the entire series. Ironically, the first story is only possibly beaten out in controversy by the final novella. To quote George Lucas, it's like poetry. It rhymes.
Oh, brother, this guy stinks!
Frailty begins with Jack, an EMT, and his partner Dave failing to revive a teenager who crashed his car during a storm. Starting off strong here. Just as they're about to leave, Jack spots a frail and obfuscated figure performing a mysterious ritual over the boy's body. When Jack yells the figure in the shadows, it quickly flees, but, miraculously, the boy he just pronounced dead regained consciousness. This mysterious figure is Jessica, a 14-year-old student and part-time janitor at a hospital with the supernatural ability to heal others from even the brink of death by scraping silver from her heart-shaped pendant onto others, but in doing so, it also takes away from her own vitality and causes her to become increasingly more and more frail. Despite the hospital staff's confusion over a rampant amount of silver dust and random junk being discovered around patients, Jessica successfully hid her secret and saved innocent souls from untimely deaths, which is why she also works in the children's wing of the hospital. The reason she has this magic pendant in the first place is due to her own life taking a tragic turn after just one bad day. One bad decision, which led her to running away from home, and after a series of unfortunate events, she now lives in a cemetery, maintaining a low profile at school. What's that? That doesn't answer how she got the pendant? What, are you accusing me of pivoting away from the mystery? Being evasive? How rude. Jessica says, quote, staying under the radar unfortunately changes when she is partnered with a new student in her science class named Robert. As Jessica and Robert work together and grow closer, Jessica begins to believe she is harboring feelings towards him and becomes torn between her mission and her desire for a normal life again. She chooses to attend her school prom with Robert but is humiliated when Robert kisses her during their dance and subsequently begins to gag and spit oil and grease from his mouth. Jessica flees, believing she doesn't deserve happiness, with this night as proof of that. Returning to the hospital, Jessica's condition deteriorates drastically. She locks herself in April's room, a young child no older than 3, whose health was not improving no matter what the doctors had done to her. She used the rest of her pendant on her, believing that it would be enough to save her life. The staff finally break the lock and rush in, only to find a pile of metal junk and grease where Jessica stood. As they stand there questioning where she disappeared to, while the few who put together the truth of Jessica began to mourn, April's heart monitor began to beat a healthy rhythm. As a standalone narrative, I have nothing but praise for Frailty. It's a bittersweet tale of someone seeking redemption but failing to forgive themselves, with a touch of the paranormal to enhance its poignancy. Jessica is written very well, and although I didn't delve into it much, the subplot with the hospital staff looking into Jessica's well-being adds a nice, heartwarming touch to the narrative. Ironically, despite the darker tones of the narrative, Frailty always leaves me feeling a little warm in the heart. It's strangely beautiful how the story focuses on the best of humanity, those seeking redemption yet unable to forgive themselves, and those who see someone in a bad situation and offer support. Don't get me wrong, my cold, steel-wool-hating heart may be warmed by this story, but my cynical mind hasn't been completely won over. For starters, and I can't really ignore it, this story doesn't connect well to the FNAF mythos. I didn't even mention any FNAF iconographical elements in my brief summary. The only deliberate line tying this story to the Five Nights at Freddy's world is a throwaway comment in the hospital where a parent tells their son they are going to the Mega Pizzaplex. It's a literal blink and you miss it moment in writing. Which, to be fair, while I do appreciate FNAF iconographical representation, I can handle a story lacking visual appeal as long as it utilizes the lore and world in a deeper, more expansive manner. But, oh, Frailty does not do that. This book doesn't succeed in expanding the lore, instead it confuses those of us who try to keep track of the continuity in this already complex, very lucid universe. It integrates an element from the Fazbear Fright series, which, before the release of this book, was widely accepted as an alternate universe of the game canon without doing anything to explain its existence. It almost feels like this story was intended to be a direct sequel to the Fazbear Fright story To Be Beautiful, given the heart-shaped pendant and the POV child made of garbage. However, because tales exist in a somewhat nebulous part of the continuity, it seems the story had to be altered to fit the mainline canon. This likely explains why no effort was made to provide context for Jessica's abilities and mysterious past and the throwaway line connecting it to the Pizzaplex. For this reason, I'm placing Frailty at the top of B tier for now. Depending on how things progress, I could move it up to the bottom of A tier or drop it to the bottom of B. It's by no means a boring read and offers great emotional storytelling, despite its flaws in connection to the wider FNAF franchise. Lally's Game. Selena and Cade, an engaged couple preparing for their wedding, move into an old farmhouse to be closer to Cade's mother, who needs to be cared for. As they are moving things back and forth between Cade's home and their new one, Selena notices Cade has a large and worn trunk she has never seen before. When she tries to ask Cade about it, he simply states it only contains old memories. At Cade's mother's house, Selena discovers an old photo album showing Cade's frequent visits to the Freddy Fazbear Mega Pizzaplex as a child, particularly his fascination and love with an animatronic character named Lally for the Blackland Arena called Lally's Game. However, Cade is evasive about his childhood, particularly when Lally went missing after an incident at the Pizzaplex. Selena grows suspicious about his evasiveness, but sets her doubts aside after they marry, because that's healthy. When she is inevitably reminded of Cade's mysterious trunk, she searches for it, only to find it hidden behind a bunch of boxes. She unlatches the locks to it, but before she can open up to see what's inside, Cade returns and she decides right then to confront Cade about his secrecy. Cade, after learning she opened the box, dashes to it and discovers that it is empty. Eventually, he confesses that Lally, the animatronic, followed him home and he was trapped in that trunk.
That's not good.
Selena initially believes this is just a manifestation of his childhood trauma, but eerie occurrences make her question her skepticism. During a party, Selena briefly sees Lally in the garage, and later is haunted by noises and a sense of being watched.
Okay, that's not good!
She learns from Janice, Cade's mom, that Lally's game was a make-believe hide-and-seek Cade took very seriously. Lally was in fact not an animatronic and more so a posable mannequin that lonely children could play with. Selena's fears escalate, culminating in a terrifying confrontation where Cade reveals his belief that upsetting Lally means death for her. In a panic, believing that Cade had completely lost it, Selena strikes Cade and hides, only to be found by someone, brutally murdered, and stuffed into Lally's box. Years later, Cade, now remarried, hides the sinister trunk in his new home as he and his new bride leaves the room. Two glowing irises appear over the box, hinting at the cycle repeating. I have to mention this because, at the time of recording, this novella is hilariously the furthest event in the FNAF timeline. The story takes place after the Pizzaplex has closed down, and it was already closed when Cade and Selena were children. So this story is set years, if not decades, after security breach, ruin, and Help Wanted 2. Just something funny I love to point out. As for the story itself, I mentioned this in the Lala Games review. My one big criticism is how it ends. The story does a great job of continuously escalating the tension around Lally and balancing the mystery of whether or not Lally is actually capable of moving around, or if Cade is losing it to some weird hide personality that emerges when Lally is unlocked from his chest. However, the ending makes it clear that something paranormal is afoot, which, in my opinion, undermines the narrative's potential impact and creepiness. The story would have been much more effective if it fully linked into the ambiguity of whether or not Cade was delusional or if Lally was actually animate, focusing instead on Cade's remarriage and the possibility of this being a vicious cycle of brides unreeling on their way to the slaughterhouse. How many women has Cade killed because of Lally, or because of Lally? It could have really solidified the story as FNAF's true foray into the thriller or psychological horror subgenre, but it falls back to ye olde reliable, which in some ways it can't fault, but in many ways, I will. I don't have many criticisms beyond the ending, and even then, the ending doesn't ruin the story, it just stops it from reaching perfection. I'm not doing a good job of making this sound appealing, am I? Look, if you enjoy psychological horror and true crime stories, this is the closest FNAF gets to that genre, towing the line without crossing over to an M for mature rating. Because of that, I think we can safely put this in A tier, though I suspect it will end up near the middle of A as we continue. Under Construction. We begin with a teenage girl named Maya visiting Freddy Fazbear's Mega Pizzaplex with her friends Noelle and Jack. God damn it, not this frickin' name again.
Jackon.
That person, to celebrate her 16th birthday. While eating a few slices of pizza,
Jackon
shares a theory about quantum immortality, suggesting our human consciousness never dies but continues in alternate realities. Maya somewhat pays attention, but is mainly focused on imagining what the newest attraction of the Pizzaplex, an AR simulation called The World Celebrates You, would be like. The attraction claims to give the illusion of a perfect birthday party, where everyone inside the Pizzaplex celebrates the user. After stopping by a VR booth that currently is spewing out smoke, standard Fazbear stuff, nothing to see here, Maya drags her friends to the AR unit. However, Maya is devastated to learn that the booth is closed with a sign on the exhibit reading, "Closed, under construction." Gosh, I wonder why. Ignoring the sign, they enter an AR unit which immediately immerses Maya in a perfect birthday party scenario. Everyone in the Pizzaplex, every animatronic, and even everybody she knew from her life was there celebrating her special day. The next day, Maya experiences headaches where the AR headband touched her, but dismisses them as coincidences. Over the following year, her family members and friends begin succumbing to cancer, and Maya realizes that something is wrong when no one else seems concerned. She becomes increasingly isolated as her world fills with cancer-stricken relatives and strange, jelly-like creatures that grow into adult blobs within days. That kind of escalated so quickly. By Christmas, Maya's entire family is ill, and the world around her is basically slowly becoming the Walking Dead. The jelly creatures multiply rapidly, evading public spaces and even her own home. The people are literally keeling over from cancer and dying in the streets. As she tries to treat her sick family, she wonders if this sick reality isn't her true one, but instead a false one created by AR technology, on some form of metaphor based on consciousness theory. Eventually, her house is overrun by the creatures, and Maya is consumed by them, experiencing the sensation of being crushed and suffocated. Yet, she remains conscious, trapped in a never-ending cycle of existence, questioning if death will ever come. Before we start, let's begin a counter for when a tale story uses the concept of being trapped in a simulation as a story beat, and put a one up there. But hey, I can't speak ill of the concept if it's done right, and Under Construction does it really well. As I mentioned in Lolly's Game, a perfect ending can really amplify a story. The horrifying concept of being just in perpetual existence, not dying, yet not technically living, is a horrifying purgatory to imagine yourself in. The story's use of cognitive dissonance is what really makes it stand out. Maya not only having to endure this hellish world that is both metaphorically and literally dying around her, but she also has to deal with the fact that no one around her sees anything wrong with it is disturbingly eerie. If you ever listen to Poor Man's Poison, it kind of reminds me of their newest album's main song, Let's Go, which really focuses on how sometimes the world around you can feel like a circus, and you have to double check that you aren't insane or just part of the act. And to directly quote from that very song,
yeah, this is how the story goes. The more you pay attention, the more you know. Nobody wins if everybody dies. So welcome to the show.
Great use of the FNAF universe with the quick beginning in the Mega Pizzaplex as well. Maya herself is also a pretty good character, with her heart being the more prominent character trait of hers. Interesting visuals with the jelly creatures and the disturbing but never really fleshed out details of the fact that humans are giving birth to them as well. All while ending with the implication that Maya will be forever trapped in this never-ending simulation. Oh, fantastic. We're placing this gem at the top of A, surpassing Lolly's Game. While both are fantastic, Under Construction excelled in sticking the landing with its concept, whereas Lolly's Game faltered just ever so slightly. Into the Night will be right back after these messages.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
You know, I believe if I were to rank book two, it probably would be my second favorite book in the entire Tales collection, despite having, in my opinion, one story that is very basic. That being said, the Into the Night community is somewhat split on where to put it. It seems everyone agrees it's at least not D tier below, but it's a pretty even 20% split between S, A, B, and even C. So, let's see what's inside. Help wanted. Oof, get ready for a meta one, boys. Steve, a janitor at the Gas Up, dreams of being a video game designer and spends his free time creating family-friendly video games. One day, a talent acquisition agent from Fazbear Entertainment, who gives his name as Brock Edwards, offers him a job to create horror games based on the company's dark past. Steve rejects the offer, not wanting to compromise his principles or be far from Amanda, a girl he's been texting. Soon after, Steve is lured by another woman named Victoria through a dating app, and he cancels his plan with Amanda to visit her because Steve is thinking with the wrong head. Arriving at Victoria's seemingly empty house, Steve is overwhelmed by a mechanical whirring and high-pitched screeching, leading him to passing out. Steve wakes up in a furnished version of the house, where Victoria informs him they are married and have children, attributing his confusion to a car accident-induced memory loss. Eventually, alerted to his sudden family's financial constraints, Steve starts to work on the horror games for Fazbear Entertainment. As time passes, the house begins to manifest an eerie aura, with pulsating walls, oily substances, and bizarre creatures attacking him. Once they get into the colder times of the year, the radio host of the home's one and only radio network, DJ Dan, announces a heavy blizzard, trapping the family inside for months. Steve's grip on reality weakens because of this, but he persists in creating the games, which seems to miraculously alleviate his distress. Steve's paranoia culminates when, in an effort to stop the ringing in his ears, he destroys all the fire alarms in his home. But when the ringing ceases, so does his current perception of the world he once knew, as his beloved Victoria and his children are revealed to be robots. As he hides from his faux family, DJ Dan, now revealed to be a part of the ruse as well, speaks through the radio to him directly, urging Steve to accept this artificial reality for his own happiness. DJ Dan promises bliss if Steve pushes the red button on the radio, reactivating the illusionary devices. After succumbing to DJ Dan's sweet nothings, Steve presses the button, which results in a high-pitched ringing returning. As the room spins, Steve suddenly finds himself in a seemingly perfect reality with Victoria, feeling immense bliss despite a continuous, literal, stabbing pain in his heart. First and foremost, I have to give props to this story for reintroducing the illusion disc from the Silver Eyes novel trilogy and proving that the concept itself isn't terrible for FNAF. Rather, the execution of the previous books was at fault for their botched introduction. I appreciate that, unlike Frailty, Help Wanted utilizes a previous experimental object in the series and not only expands upon it, but does so without directly using the iconography. Nowhere in the book is the term illusion disc mentioned, but for those familiar with it, it's clear that this is exactly what the story is doing. It provides a nice little reward for those who know their FNAF lore. As I mentioned before, this story proves that the concept of illusion discs isn't inherently flawed. Rather, it was the lack of believability in their execution in the novel trilogy that was at fault. Help Wanted makes a smart decision by confining Steve to one building designed with the illusion discs in mind. This not only enhances the immersion of the story, but also paints Phasmer Entertainment in a much darker light for how far they were willing to go to manipulate Steve into working on their games, especially unsettling in the realization that, with his limited social context outside, Phasmer Entertainment hired him not for his skills, but because he was always going to be an easy loose end for them to tie up. Which, if the name of the novella was any indication, is also the loose end presented in Help Wanted, the video game, with the independent game developer which helped Phasmer Entertainment come back into the public's good graces. Somehow, when it comes to utilizing the FNAF world and expanding on it, this novella is probably the most prominent in that pillar of critique. As for my ranking, I can understand why some people might place this in S tier, truly. However, I think I'm going to position this one right at the top of A, even above Under Construction. While I thoroughly enjoyed it, I had to admit that Steve Snodgrass, aside from his name, was somewhat of a forgettable protagonist. If he wasn't a direct parody of Scott Cawthon, I don't think he would be as memorable. Additionally, while it's intriguing that those familiar with FNAF lore can anticipate the twist, I believe even a regular reader can foresee that Phasmer Entertainment is behind Steve's new and wonderful life, albeit not the exact reasoning behind it. So, I can see why some people might feel the story slows down a bit in the middle before the rising action. Besides, I can't ignore the fact that my affection for this novella might be partly due to Help Wanted episode of the podcast. That project was one of my favorites because of the talented voices I enlisted, the intricate soundscaping editing I had to tackle, and even my own portrayal as Brock Edwards. It marked the first time I felt genuinely proud of my own character performance on the show. So, to try and maintain a little non-bias, we'll put this on the top of A. It's not quite S, but it's very close to achieving that status. Haps. Aiden, a 15-year-old outcast who recently moved to a new town where he struggles to fit in, despite his disastrous attempt to make friends through a talent show audition, where he humiliates himself in front of the entire student body, he does find one new friend in Jace, the only person who stands by and understands him. Together, they explore Freddy Fazbear's Mega Pizzaplex, where Aiden hopes to find some inspiration in an effort to regain control over his life. To blow off steam, they decide to enter Freddy's Fortress, a maze filled with colorful tubes that sprawl all over the Pizzaplex and supervised by Haps, a maintenance bot. In the maze, Aiden and Jace enjoy scaring younger kids until they encounter Haps cleaning a suspiciously bulging tube. As they attempt to investigate how Haps moves around and cleans the tubes, they end up in a restricted part of the tube maze and become cornered by Haps. They intentionally destroy him as Haps is attempting to grab the kids and bring them back to the main part of the attraction, but Aiden and Jace end up accidentally knocking the tube they are in loose during the process, falling into an offshoot part of the maze. They attempt to escape and get back to the main area, but are continuously thwarted by Haps, who is still attempting to fulfill his duties, but can't comprehend that his now damaged body is causing his pursuit to damage and destroy the maze itself, and, most likely, will end up skewering the boys. Despite their efforts to attract attention from the outside, they remain trapped and unheard, isolated from the oblivious activity of the outside world. As the situation escalates, Aiden grapples with the reality of their predicament and the consequences of their actions. They struggle for survival intensifies as Haps becomes increasingly aggressive, eventually snatching and killing Jace. Alone and haunted by the grief of his dead friend, Aiden confronts the chilling realization of his newfound invisibility, a bittersweet fulfillment of his desire for control in the face of overwhelming adversity. And that's about it. Yeah, this is a short one. And that's kind of the problem. It's telling when you can summarize this story as two kids beat up a robot, robot chases after the kids, and the story ends with the robot inevitably killing both kids. The end? While there are some deeper themes of invisibility and the consequences of acting out on others instead of working on yourself here, the main draw of the story, the titular Haps, is quite basic. Look, I like the concept. Haps is pretty interesting as a robot whose design and purpose have a real-world basis, without disgusting sky mazes and ball pits are in reality. Ever wondered why Chuck E. Cheese got rid of them? Turns out, it's really hard for adults to clean and disinfect an attraction meant only for toddlers to be able to navigate. Kind of a huge design flaw. Perhaps once he's destroyed, merely becomes a relentless monster chasing the kids without much further development. Its destruction occurs early on too, on around page 20, and for the subsequent 50 pages, the plot largely remains stagnant, with little progression leading up to the conclusion. It seems like a missed opportunity to reduce such a creative concept to a simple chase narrative. While a chase story might be more suitable for a video game format, in a book or novella, it can feel somewhat tedious to navigate through. It's disappointing when a potentially rich concept isn't fully explored or utilized to its fullest extent. It's unfortunate, but unsurprising, that this will be our first C-tier story. While it still contains some great FNAF concepts and the characters are well written, the narrative can feel like a slog. A cool concept alone can't save a story that feels like a chore to finish, you know? B7. Oh boy. Oh boy, here we go. B7. This story is incredible. And just to preface this is a story with very little to do, iconographically wise, with FNAF, but it is closely tied to its themes and symbolism. But okay. B7 focuses on the story of Billy. When Billy was 3 years old, he was put into medical intensive care and had to be away from his family while treated, resulting in trauma from the event. Now 5, he likes watching the TV, especially the show Freddy and Friends. He likes the idea of being a big animatronic, as they're strong and don't feel bad things like people do. He is drawn to the idea of robotic strength and specifically emotional detachment. When mimicking his favorite characters lands him in trouble, Billy's parents reluctantly indulge his fantasy, hoping it's just a phase, as he claims he is an animatronic. As Billy's behavior persists, however, his parents seek professional advice, urged to play along to prevent a potential psychological breakdown. Despite efforts to integrate him into reality, Billy's fixation deepens. His private schooling introduces him to robotics, where his fascination turns self-destructive as he begins ingesting oil, mistaking it for a necessary component of his imagined identity. Years pass, and Billy's detachment from reality is only getting worse. His mother, Vera, becomes his sole caretaker, as his father's heart can't bear being in the same home as a son he can't help and a wife that tortures herself. As Vera's concern is overshadowed by her commitment to the family's true well-being. As Billy's delusions solidify, Vera's mental and physical health deteriorates, eventually causing her, in words that I've been told I have to say to not get in trouble, self-deletes on Billy's 18th birthday. Now, all on his own, Billy is desperate to shed his human form and undergoes extreme surgeries by a criminal doctor seeking to embody his robotic ideal. Yet each procedure is never enough, and he continues to go under more and more alterations until he faces the stark realization that he irreversibly mutilated himself. Alone and broken, he seeks solace in the wreckage of a junkyard, with no real plan, just running on autopilot. Hiding in a broken down car, he eventually awakes to find out on the path of a car compactor, but he doesn't alert any of the workers. It instead succumbs to the compactor's crushing embrace, bleeding profusely from every orifice and every bone in his body breaking. While he is in indescribable pain, he is happy because every ounce of pain is a reminder and proof that he is and always was human. I have lost count of how many times I've said this, but the B7 two-parter story may just be the pinnacle of storytelling in the entire FNAF mythos. While the story of Michael is fantastic in its own right, don't get me wrong, I love Michael Lapton's story, B7 stands out as truly exceptional, particularly if you're an older FNAF fan like myself. This tale's smaller scale, devoid of supernatural or sci-fi elements, lends it a raw and engaging realism. Billy's mental health struggles and the reactions of those around him, the choices made by his parents, therapist, society, his girlfriend, the doctor, and Billy himself are all impeccably portrayed. They weave a narrative that highlights the dangers of living in a fantasy, not just for the individual, but also the dangers of that for the closest that are to him. Furthermore, it sheds light on society's apathy towards perceived burdens rather than extending a helping hand. The ending is tragically poignant, driving home the importance of facing reality rather than succumbing to delusion before it's too late. It serves as a stark reminder of the necessity to give our all to those we support and we love and prevent them from going down the bad choice road. We'll delve deeper into these themes in the next part with B7-2, because this part, the first one, explores the darker aspects of humanity and the battles we must confront. Whereas B7-2 shifts its focus to themes of healing, the significance of community, the beauty of sacrifice, and the belief in second chances. B7 has rightfully earned its place as the first S-tier story, and it's no surprise to anyone familiar with my taste. The story is truly incredible, and while it maybe a bit intense for a younger audience, in fact, I found myself astonished that it was written for the FNAF franchise in the first place. Just know if you pick it up, you are in it for an immersive and compelling, albeit very, very mature read that grips you from the very start and refuses to let go. When you pick it up, you're going to read it the whole way through in one sitting. Trust me. Into the Night will be right back after these messages.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Thank you. Book number 3, Somnophobia. I was surprised to see that most of the ITN community ranked this so high, with 43% of the vote for S tier and 25% for A tier. Not that the stories in book 3 are the worst or even bad, just kind of average, in my opinion. Somnophobia. High school senior Sam Barker navigates the complexities of friendship and personal demons stemming from his father's tragic death a year prior. His tight-knit group of friends often tease him for his anxieties and strict routines, exasperating his struggles. At his best friend, Rad's birthday party, his friend group wins a Moondrop Dream Sphere, a top prize that can only be won by the most dedicated of ticket collectors at the Freddy Fazbear Pizzaplex. Originally, the group got it because they believed it would help them cram and study for their upcoming exams. The Dream Sphere creates a proxy, hallucinatory vision and lifelike illusions that make the user near it feel groggy and light, lost in a world of make-believe. Despite his initial skepticism, Sam finds solace and joy in the Dream Sphere's immersive experiences, especially after he goes over the recommended time limit, where the Dream Sphere delves deeper into Sam's mindscape and reconnects him with cherished memories of his father. However, as Sam's dependence on the Dream Sphere grows, so does his detachment from the real world, straining his relationships and his grip on reality. Haunted by traumatic memories and fueled by an insatiable desire for escapism, Sam spirals into an addictive obsession, ignoring warnings and sacrificing genuine connections in pursuit of fleeting euphoria. The Dream Sphere becomes both a sanctuary and a prison, offering tantalizing escapes while ensnaring Sam in a perilous cycle of addiction. Sam's final encounter with the Dream Sphere takes a dark turn as he becomes trapped in a haunting memory of his father's death. Struggling to escape the vivid recollection, Sam's grip on reality falters. Realizing the perilous consequences of his obsession with the fantasy, Sam resolves to return the Dream Sphere to Rad, seeking liberation from its consuming influence. Arriving at Rad's house to find it empty, Sam finds himself ensnared by the allure of the Dream Sphere's warmth and vibrations, succumbing to its seductive pull to have one last adventure before giving it up forever. He tries to make it the best fantasy ever created. His friends worship him, his father alive and well, and even his enemies admit to his superiority over them. But as Sam tries to turn off the Dream Sphere, no matter what he tries to do, he can't move his body in the real world. He then comes to a troubling realization. He never plugged the Dream Sphere in. Suddenly, Moondrop appears behind him, and when he waves his hand at Sam, he is immediately at peace. Moondrop walks out the door and Sam follows, excited for more adventures. Meanwhile, the Moondrop in the Dream Sphere, in the real world, slowly stops spinning with a click. Now, I'm a big fan of tale stories having a deeper narrative, and Somnophobia probably has the most obvious what its symbolic storytelling is attempting to convey in the entirety of the tale's collection. When you hear that a kid is sacrificing his attachment to the real world and his friends and family to pursue the momentary luxury of an item that makes him feel groggy, light, and gives him euphoric hallucinations that slowly become addictive over time, what does that sound like? Does it sound like the story about the dangers of drug abuse? Congratulations, you have found the symbolic meaning of the narrative. Now, that isn't meant to disparage the writing. Nowhere is it written in stone with golden ebony that a story must be vague to carry deeper meaning. While Somnophobia's underlying narrative may not be entirely original, its concept and execution certainly are. The descriptive language used to portray the hallucinatory visions induced by the Dream Sphere is incredibly creative, vividly illustrating how alien the experience feels, while subtly hinting at its metaphorical representation. It's just by the third act, any subtlety is abandoned as the story delves full-on into the narrative of addiction, with the character grappling with their struggle, experiencing brief moments of improvement, only to ultimately relapse again. I'm not sure if there are any supernatural implications with the Moondrop device, at least not overtly. Tales tends to be conservative in employing preternatural forces to explain the threats in the narratives. However, I love the use of the Day Keratin as the mascot for the device. It's thematically appropriate, with the moon sign of the Day Keratin representing a sleep-inducing device. Furthermore, though, there's a metaphorical level to it, retreating from the real world and allowing something else to take care of your worries for a while. The main issue I have with the narrative, which we'll also see in Pressure and throughout Book 3 really, can be summarized as follows. They're all stories where the greatest threats lie in how cruel and apathetic people are towards others. While this element was present in B7, I appreciated it there, Book 3 really leans into this concept without achieving the same intentional and evocative impact as B7. Fazbear Frights faced a similar challenge in many of its entries, where the plot often revolves around how the peer groups of the character, especially if they are children POV characters, are filled with just horrible people. And this recycling of the same group dynamic, it can make the messaging feel less substantial and nuanced. It also makes me wonder if some of these writers had difficulty in their own peer groups when they were younger. Given the depth and weight of Somnophobia's narrative, I do feel confident placing it in A tier. Now, I just need to decide where to position it. How about right here, below Help Wanted, but above Under Construction? You know, now that I'm looking at this list and getting into some more novellas, my placement of Lally's Games is starting to feel really off. I think I put that a little too high. We're going to drop that down to the top of B tier for right now. Yeah, that looks good. That looks good. Pressure. Seventeen-year-old Luca, with aspirations of coaching in the NFL, grapples with his haunting past. The abduction and murder of his childhood friend, Kenny. Nightmares plague him. The memory keeps repeating in his head, and it's straining his friendships, particularly with Nolan, who is now dating Luca's crush, Maddie. Amidst the bustling atmosphere of Freddy Fazbear's Mega Pizzaplex, Luca and his friends engage in the Urban Legend Role Players Auditorium, that's a name, and Luca harbors suspicions that Fazbear Entertainment is employing these games to mask genuine paranormal activity stemming from past tragedies caused by its co-founder, William Afton, while also profiting off those incidents as well, though his friends brush aside his concerns. You know, those absolutely provable in a court of law accusational concerns. Reluctantly, Luca finds himself coerced into donning a spring trap suit during the game in a Fazbear Fright roleplay event. As the scenario unfolds, his unease intensifies as he becomes increasingly aware that this supposed replica of the infamous spring trap suit is actually an old spring lock costume. Tragically, the moment he realizes this is the time the spring locks go off and he sustains fatal injuries. He tries to call out to his friends who abandon him, mistaking his gargles and wet screams as part of the game. Reflecting on his life during a camping trip memory with his father, Luca gains clarity on his peers' influence on him and how they pressure him to change who he is. His friends truly didn't care for him, and if they would, they would have respected his anxiety and helped him through his trauma. Returning to the present, he collapses in a storage room as his friends leave the game, unaware of his plight and literally just abandon him. Side note, I headcanon that these kids get hit by an oncoming Faz coaster, like the way that one chick from Mean Girls gets hit by the bus, but that's besides the point. As Luca awakens, he cautiously navigates the backstage, where he notices several costumes swaying eerily. Taking cover behind the stage curtain, he observes three figures entering the dining room, three children to be specific. Contemplating his next move, Luca's thoughts are interrupted as a suspicious-looking employee dons a spring lock suit. Inadvertently, Luca makes a noise, causing the children to scatter. Driven by instinct, Luca rushes to a nearby maintenance closet, where he encounters one of the girls desperately struggling against the employee's grasp. He realizes that this disturbed-looking man was trying to reenact the actions of William Afton. Seizing the opportunity, the girl sinks her teeth into the employee's forearm, allowing her to break free and flee. Without hesitation, Luca launches himself at the employee, initiating a desperate struggle. As the altercation ensues, Luca's mind races, memories flooding back, showcasing the unfulfilled aspirations and dreams he will never realize. But in that climactic moment, as he chokes out the last remaining life of the Springtrap wannabe, Luca's own existence fades away. But not before acknowledging that his inner guidance had been true all along, and his final act of bravery was a testament to his autonomy and resolve. Before I dive in with any cynicism, I want to emphasize that I genuinely value the message of this story. It's crucial to be discerning of fake people and prioritize authenticity and genuine relationships with peers who have your best interest at heart. The ending, where the POV character sacrifices their last moments to save an innocent life instead of prioritizing their own survival, resonates deeply with me. You all know how much I cherish stories of heroic sacrifice, and Luca absolutely claims that. But, okay, holy crap. Do a lot of things in this plot and just not add up. Like, what's with the spring lock suit just lying around? Are you telling me Fazbear Entertainment casually whipped up a one-to-one replica of the spring body suit for people to wear in this roleplay arena? Come on. This is the same Fazbear Entertainment that supposedly clued in on all the supernatural shenanigans from the past, including the dangers of the spring logs and the suit's notorious reputation. It's downright absurd. Unless you're trying to tell me that the suits belong to the employee who was trying to harm the kids, which, let's be real, is also just too convenient, it's bizarre because, as we'll see time and time again, even in the next upcoming novella, that does not align with how Fazbear Entertainment operates in the modern era. Fazbear Entertainment in the Secure Breach era typically hires professionals for important roles, and as we discover in the Bobby Dot storyline, they even conduct thorough background checks on their employees. So how did this guy slip under the radar? It feels way too contrived, like an excuse for Luca to be the hero at the end and make a Willie Afton Purple Guy reference, without actually making sense within the context of Fazbear Entertainment's current persona. Considering all of that, this is going straight to C tier, just above halves. Luca's character and the message of the story prevent it from sinking to D tier, but the plot and concept drag it down for being anything more than average. Honestly, pressure epitomizes what C tier kind of stands for. It kind of sets a baseline for judging whether something is above or below it. Clythrophobia. As 27-year-old Grady, on the cusp of his 28th birthday, 2 days from retirement and a day from his pension, wraps up his carousel inspection at the currently under construction Freddy Fazbear Mega Pizzaplex, memories of a traumatic event from 23 years ago haunt him because everyone's got a tragic past in these novellas. Left in a linen closet for hours by a neglectful babysitter and her boyfriend, Grady emerged with clythrophobia, a fear of confined spaces, shaping his life thereafter. Raised on a diet of comfort food, Grady's adolescent years saw his fears gradually recede, save for situations where escape wasn't evident. He's currently hired by Fazbear Entertainment with future hopes of going into a programming position there. Grady finds himself a maintenance technician currently, preparing the Pizzaplex for its grand opening. Alone, after his colleagues Tate and Ronan depart, Grady faces the malfunctioning security system and the daunting task of testing attractions like Ballora's Fitness and Flex, designed to guide players through narrow tubes for fitness and pizza. Despite his trepidation, Grady embarks on the test, determined to ensure no child suffers the same fate as he did in confined spaces. As Grady descends into the depths of the attraction, he encounters Glamrock Ballora, an animatronic attendant offering assistance if he gets stuck. Pressing onward, Grady navigates through increasingly constricting passages until he becomes trapped. Desperate for escape, he calls out to Ballora, whose attempt to free him only results in excruciating injuries, leaving him incapacitated and in agonizing pain. Meanwhile, Ronan and Tate return to retrieve some forgotten items and stumble upon Grady's horrifying predicament. Fearing repercussions for themselves, they debate calling for help, but ultimately leave Grady to his fate. Overhearing the conversation, Grady's suffering intensifies, but he finds a perverse comfort in the company of Ballora, welcoming the nightmarish embrace of death. You know, I appreciate this story more than Pressure, particularly because it delves deeper into the lore of Fazbear Entertainment. Now they manage to maintain their public standing by paying their employees generously. Ironically, this financial incentive leads some employees to turn a blind eye to the company's more nefarious activities. However, I can't overlook the fact that a story suffers from the same problems that Haps kind of has, presenting the concept without much for the development on it. Similar to Haps, the story doesn't venture beyond its initial premise. It revolves around an attraction within the closed-down section of the Pizzaplex, offering little in terms of a surprising twist. However, it does do a better job than Haps in expanding on the FNAF lore in intriguing ways. For instance, the location of Glamrock Ballora's attraction can be identified as one of the closed-off hallways found in Security Breach. Additionally, the presence of a Glamrock Ballora itself adds depth to the lore. It was cool to also see the Pizzaplex under construction, so we got that too? Oh boy, I'm really struggling to find stuff to praise in this story. Listen, I'm sorry, but Clythrophobia is going to the top of C tier. It surpasses Haps and Pressure because it contributes more to the FNAF lore, and I'll admit, this scene with Glamrock Ballora butchering Grady is downright horrifying. However, once you look past that, the story itself is rather basic. Into the Night will be right back after these messages.
Menards is your electrical headquarters. We carry all the tools and testers you need for any electrical job. Stack up your toolbox with Southwire electrical products today. Right now, save big money on Southwire electrical tools, testers, cable ties, wire, and cable. Shop our huge selection in store at Menards. Ranked number one in customer satisfaction among home improvement retailers according to J.D. Power. For more information, visit jdpower.com/awards.
Save big money at Menards.
Find all your 4th of July needs at low prices, all in the Kroger app. Get USDA Choice Bone-In Tender Ribeye Steaks for $7.99 a pound with a digital coupon. Limit 5, then buy 2, get 3 free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
All right, book number 4, Submechanophobia, probably the clearest definition of the we're back, we're Jover, and we're so back in this entire series. Although, once again, I may be in the minority here. The ITN community seems to love it, with 40% believing it is S tier. But then again, I think people are judging the book purely on an entertainment spectacle rather than a measure of actual quality. What do I mean by that? Give me one second. Submechanophobia. Caden Wachowski, a 19-year-old technician at Freddy's Fantasy Water Park, carries a heavy burden of fears and responsibilities. Submechanophobia, rooted in a childhood tragedy, plagues him, as does the memory of his parents' disappearance at sea when he was just 6 years old. Despite therapy and the care of his grandmother, Caden's life has been marred by ridicule and bullying since a traumatic incident on a school field trip involving underwater animatronics. That is so oddly specific. Yet, driven by love and duty, he perseveres, channeling his mechanical skills into a job at Freddy's Fantasy Water Park to support his ailing grandmother. Fun fact, this park was in operation before Fazbear Entertainment went bankrupt, but is now back in operation, unofficially, to skirt off the success of the Mega Pizzaplex, two towns down the road. Driven by a sense of responsibility towards his grandmother and the need to maintain their home, Caden perseveres in his role at the water park, tackling mechanical repairs despite his apprehensions and fears, tasked primarily with the maintenance of Freddy's Sea Life Mega Aquarium. However, strange occurrences begin to unsettle Caden, from peculiar encounters with malfunctioning animatronics to eerie discoveries of human remains within the Megaquarium. As he delves deeper into the park's mysteries, he uncovers a web of deceit and danger, implicating the park's owner, Martin Cooper, in a sinister cover-up of the death of a young boy named Jason Butterfield due to the failed safety measures being implemented in the park. As twilight settles over the park, Caden waits until the last visitor departs and security guard Roy retreats to the front office. With determined resolve, he plunges once more into the depths of the Megaquarium in his quest for answers. Caden's search yields a human skull buried amidst the artificial ocean floor. Yet, before he can process the gravity of his find, he looks up and finds he is sealed within the confines of the tank, trapping him inside without an escape. One of the animatronics, Frank the Diver, quickly launches at Caden, attempting to drown him. In a desperate struggle for survival, Caden wrenches off Frank's helmet, exposing the unexpected truth. Martin Cooper lurks within the suit, not an animatronic. Before Martin can inflict further harm, an animatronic sea dragon named Zeus intervenes, ensnaring him with his tail and preventing him from escaping. As the other animatronics in the tank converge, they ensure Martin meets his demise beneath the water, holding him until he succumbs to the depths. A week later, Caden returns to the now closed park to tie up some loose ends. Police uncovered the remains of Jason Butterfield within the Megaquarium, exposing Martin's heinous cover-up. Caden's bravery and determination also earned him widespread acclaim, with the town hailing him as a local hero. Amidst the gratitude and recognition, Roy approaches Caden, unveiling plans to transform the park into a beacon of renewal under his stewardship, and extending an invitation for Caden to join him in shaping its future, with the tone of his voice sounding like he is expecting Caden to accept immediately. So, I don't think I did a good enough job in my summary, but this story is actually kind of a FNAF whodunit. A friend of mine, Avix, you all know, aptly described it as the closest we have ever gotten to a Michael Apted novella, and I agree with that. Caden's investigation into the mysterious remnants of the boy's body, combined with the numerous life-threatening incidents during his time at the park, transforms the narrative into a kind of thriller murder mystery, with characters like Martin the owner, Roy the security guard who has a history with the park when he was a child, and even the underwater animatronics themselves. There's a diverse cast of suspects to keep the reader engaged and guessing. The location is also such a fantastic concept. We may not be in the Pizzaplex itself, but the Megaquarium at the water park is such a unique concept, with very clear love and passion put into how many animatronics are under there. They could have just simply stated, oh, there's some underwater animatronics like a mermaid and a diver, but the story goes out of its way to clarify there's a robot shark, sea dragons, mermaids, divers, fish, dolphins, along with just normal sea life. And each robot was even named by the park staff to just add another layer of detail to them that makes the location feel that much more vivid and tangible. And let's not overlook how the story enriches the FNAF lore, both in terms of the supernatural elements and the world building. The expansion of locations beyond the Pizzaplex, driven by the opening of it, adds depth to the FNAF universe, making it feel more vibrant and expansive. What other locations are out there now because Mega Pizzaplex is a success? Additionally, the return to a classic FNAF storyline, that's just a refreshing change for me. A ghost child haunting animatronic characters until their murderer faces justice? It's a familiar yet compelling premise that resonates with an older FNAF fan like me. There's a lot to love with Submechnophobia. But is it S-tier? I can see an argument for it. Truthfully, I do. It's definitely a top 5 tale novellas for me. That's for sure. But does it breach A-tier into S? I don't know. I think I need to put that one on the back burner for now. Until we come back to it with a few more stories under our belt, we'll put Submechnophobia on top of A-tier for now. Animatronic Apocalypse. From near the top of S to, without a doubt, our first F tier, Yeah, I'm not even gonna sugarcoat it. We are just putting animatronic apocalypse into Security Breach tier. Holy shit. This story is so bad that it turns into an actual parody in of itself. I'm not even... For the sake of fairness, I will attempt to summarize in the fairest, most neutral way possible. If it sounds ridiculous, no, I am summarizing verbatim what is happening in this story. Okay, here we go. Robbie Wilson, an energetic sixth grader and an avid fan of Freddy Fazbear, is part of his school's Fazbear Fan Club, which meets twice a week and has created a game called Animatronic Apocalypse. When the club president moves away, Sabrina is elected as the new leader with a focus on winning the game. Whatever that means. She implements controversial rules, including copying homework and keeping club activities secret from the outside. By the way, the principal is the club sponsor, and he is all for this plan.
Coincidence? I think not!
Robbie, uncomfortable with the changes, notices tension rising when Beware the Animatronic Apocalypse is graffitied on the walls at school. The principal, Mr. Renner, announces a school-wide initiative to prepare for the game, but Robbie and his best friend Dyson are skeptical of the club's new direction. Robbie's distrust in the Fazbear Fan Club's new direction grows when Mr. Renner praises him for his potential role in the Faculty Preparedness Initiative, an initiative where the student body gets to decide where funds should be going. Yeah, because that sounds legit. After experiencing some strength incidents and learning of Mr. Renner's unsurprising dismissal, Robbie follows Sabrina and another one of his friends, Daniel, to a bizarre meeting in the woods where Mr. Renner convinces club members to eat dirt for immunity and eat beetles for sustenance. What? The next night, he discovers the club members buried in the ground with their heads poking out at Willow's Park. Supposedly, the reason for doing this is to cleanse themselves of animatronic toxins. Despite Sabrina's protest, Robbie rescues a kid named Nathan and seeks help from the police, who dismisses the incident as childish antics because the police are worthless in the Fazbear universe. The next day, Robbie's concerns deepen as he witnesses disturbing behavior among his peers, including his own dad consuming a beetle. Yes, the whole town is now infected with this mind virus, except for Robbie. Don't question it. At school, the absence of club members and the prevalence of an illness raises further alarms. Determined to uncover the truth, Robbie breaks into Mr. Renner's house and confronts him, only to be attacked by the principal and the club members under his influence. In a desperate struggle, Robbie fatally wounds Mr. Renner by stabbing him with an iron poker, causing him to profusely bleed black liquid from every orifice. By the way, did I mention he was wearing a Freddy Fazbear mask complete with a brown suit and black bow tie? Once Mr. Renner bleeds out, all the students snap out of the trance and immediately flee. All except Sabrina, who seems to still be a part of it. Despite it all ends well. Sabrina transferred to a new school and the club was reorganized under the leadership of Robbie. Focus now on community service and preparing for the future with the theme of the animatronic apocalypse to make it more fun. We all fail. We all make mistakes. I don't think I can begin to describe how absolutely batshit this story is. And that's before I even dive in into its potential world-breaking implications. I mean, a story where an entire town gets cultified is not something that just goes under the radar. That's statewide, if not national news. And when it's learned it has something to do with Fazbear Entertainment, with which I assume the Mega Pizzaplex is down the road. But then again, I don't know, because this story really also brings into question of how big is Fazbear Entertainment that a school has its own fan club for it. Is it a statewide institution, a local tourist attraction, or a global phenomenon? I don't know, but this story really makes me question it. The sheer number of times this story tries to muster horror for Mr. Renner's outlandish commands seems utterly oblivious of how absurd it all is. Let me reiterate. A cult of children, led by their school principal, engaging in rituals like eating dirt and beetles to rid themselves of animatronic toxins to stave off a fucking animatronic apocalypse. How am I supposed to take this plot seriously? And if you're hoping for any semblance of an explanation, well, forget it. Absolutely forget it. There's no explanation, no hint whatsoever what's really going on. Was Mr. Renner a robot? If so, how did he land the job? And why was he fixated on horse race betting earlier in the story? Sabrina also appears to be the mastermind behind it all, but what's her deal? There's no clue, and she faces no repercussions for essentially gaslighting the entire student body into forming a cult. And let's not overlook how widespread this mind virus was. Every single person in the town, from the children to the school staff to even the parents of the students, were all infected by this nonsense. Yet there's no hint of a town-wide fallout from this, nor any implication of how all this supernatural chaos is occurring under seemingly random circumstances. Oh, and there's so many stupid things in this plot. Mr. Renier's body literally disappears when he dies, and the police don't question it. Robbie is unaffected by the mind virus for no explained reason, but at the same time, it seems like students can snap out of and then back into the virus's control for also no coherent reason. And then there's just the concept of a Five Nights at Freddy's robot zombie apocalypse cult. It sounds like one of the rejected drafts for the Five Nights at Freddy's movie. F tier it goes, and full disclosure, it will rank as king, alone in that tier, because no story in this entire collection measures up to the absolute cacophony of nonsense present in this story. I have no idea how the story got Scott's seal of approval. It is so dumb, so stupid. It is an absolute disaster. But here's the thing. I'm kind of happy Scott did approve it, because this thing is so bad, it is good. This plot is seriously so brain dead. It is effectively the Room of Five Nights at Freddy's. So if I'm ever in the mood for a pick-me-up or concerned that I am not as talented of a writer as I could be, I can pick up and read this story, and my mood and outlook on life will just instantly brighten. So, in that way, I have to thank Animatronic Apocalypse. The Bobby Dots, Part 1. A security guard at Freddy Fazbear's Mega Pizzaplex has struggled with several failed business attempts and dead-end jobs. Now, he's using his tech skills and taking online classes to earn a promotion to Team Leader 2, which would allow him to live in the prestigious Fazplex Tower. This 40-story building houses Fazbear corporate offices on the lower floors and high-tech apartments for higher-level employees on the upper floors. Abe's life has taken a traumatic turn when his mother was diagnosed with early-onset dementia, leading to their house's foreclosure and replacement in long-term care. For the past 2 months, Abe has been sneaking around the Pizzaplex, scavenging for food and sleeping in a makeshift tire hut in Roxy's Raceway, and sending daily emails and money to his mother. One day, while finishing his morning routine, Abe was almost caught by Evan, a Pizzaplex team leader. Evan mentions catching up on work after attending his kid's hockey game, and comments on the tower's new holographic system called the Bobby Dots. Later, Abe is summoned to the administration office, where he receives his long-awaited promotion, which includes the luxurious apartment at the Faz Tower. However, Abe learns that there are no apartments available except for one off-limits unit. He cleverly tricks the receptionist of the apartment complex and changes the apartment status to active, although he can't remove the name of the previous tenant in the system. Excited about his new position, Abe heads to his new home, apartment 2217, on the 22nd floor. The apartment impresses him immediately, with its nearly 12-foot-high ceilings, glass upper walls in the bedroom, and areas with short half-walls topped with glass screens. As he explores, a holographic girl with hot pink pigtails appear on the glass wall, introducing herself as 3, the Diet and Lifestyle Bobby Dot. The next day, after Abe fulfills his duties as the team leader, including training a new employee named Preston about the West Arcade and its host DJ Music Man, When he returns back to his apartment, bring a box of all his possessions he had, you know, hidden around the pizzaplex, he is greeted by three again, now joined by two other Bobby Dodds. Two, who handles news and information, and one, responsible for entertainment and media. As the Bobby Dodds help organize his clothes, Abe discovers that the closet is still full of the previous tenant's clothes, which surprisingly fit him well. During dinner, Abe decides to name the Bobby Dodds to show his appreciation to them. Three becomes Rose, one is Gemini, and two is Olive. When he jokes about shutting them off, Gemini quickly informs him that they cannot be turned off. The following day, Abe notices a trap door in the ceiling between the dining and sitting areas. When he asks the Bobby Dodds about it, Gemini eventually tells him it's just for maintenance and is locked. Later at night, Abe is woken up by a strange dragging sound. He summons the Bobby Dodds to ask what the abnormality was, which subsequently stopped the moment they were summoned. Feeling watched, he asks if they record his every movement. The Bobby Dodds assure him they are aware of his movements, but do not record them, and they remain dormant at night. But Abe is hesitant to believe that. The next night, Abe wakes up at 1 a.m. to the same strange noise. Investigating, he hears sounds above him and summons the Bobby Dodds to inquire about that trap door. They explain that the noise is being caused by the first generation Bobby Dodds, which are still in the room. Whereas Rose, Gemini, and Olive, the second generation, are simply holograms on a screen, the Gen 1s were physical robots capable of moving freely but limited by their cables connected to a grid in the crawl spaces above the ceiling. Rose explains that the Gen 1s sometimes come out of their crawl space because they still want to help, but they are really bad at it. The next morning, Abe encounters bizarre malfunctions. The garbage disposal turns on while he's using it, and the jets in the tub starts boiling the water while he's in it. Olive explains the Gen 1's cables occasionally interfere with the apartment systems, and there's no update to fix these glitches. While these interferences are rare enough, Abe still endures occasional life-threatening mishaps, such as the oven catching on fire or getting electrocuted by a light switch. One day, Abe writes a rather untruthful email to his mother before going to sleep, failing to notice the cables moving through his room. However, he does hear the click of the trapdoor closing, further fueling his doubts about the Bobby Dodds and their intentions. He decides that his only solution is to get to the bottom of why the Gen 1s were disposed of and what happened to the previous tenant. And that's how it ends. Yeah, look, I know a lot of people love the Bobby Dodds two-parters. I love it too, don't get me wrong, but I have to admit, I do think part one is the only first half of the Tales two-parter that kind of suck at the conclusion mark. The plot doesn't really have a temporary resolution like in Beast 7 or The Mimic. It just kind of ends. No, it isn't even the right word for it. It just kind of pauses. Clearly, Bobby Dodds was meant to be read with the second half in mind. But you can say the same for B7 and The Mimic Origin two-parter, and both succeed in making standalone entries that work to enhance both experiences instead of relying on both to work. With all that said, I'm not arguing that the story is bad, I'm more so arguing why I'm not going to be putting it in S tier or possibly top of A. Because truthfully, Bobby Dodds is really good in so many ways. First off, Abe, besides Billy and Edward Murray, he may be my favorite written protagonist in the entire Tales series. Abe is so comical and down to earth, so jovial and big-hearted that you can't help but root for the guy. And he's not just some big oaf either. He's cunning, he's intelligent, and he has a caring side with how he loves his mother and willing to sacrifice even having a roof over his head so he doesn't have to worry about her own situation. If there is any character that I actually want to see represented in the lore somewhere in the official games, I would love to see Abe in some capacity. Maybe there's an email. I would love to see Abe again. I'm gonna make sure he's doing well. There is also so much attention to detail done when it comes to the Pizzaplex. Locations are described perfectly, one-to-one with the game, and Abe's work routine at the various attractions, explaining to his protege Preston how each location operates or ended up the way it was in Security Breach, was such a fun way to expand on the lore. Things like DJ Music Man's experimental bouncer mode activating on employees regularly, or the fact that the generators in the daycare section were in place as a consequence of both the faulty programming of the daycare attendant and faulting building construction and routing power throughout the facility is just peak Fazbear Entertainment incompetence. Being able to see more of Fazbear bureaucracy is also always a plus, especially knowing what's outside the Mega Pizzaplex is just a massive apartment complex where workers and upper Fazbear management are operating. Is such a fun little detail we never got to see in Security Breach. The Bobbydots are also a very fun antagonist, and Part 1 does a good job of keeping their nefarious antics just subtle enough that you wouldn't be able to fully paint the picture of what had happened prior to Abe taking the apartment for himself. The mystery of the prior tenant, the heirs of the Bobbydots, and the obfuscated past of the Gen 1s make it a must read. So, it's A tier. But it doesn't really excel on that metaphysical element that I love, so I can't really have it beat out Somnophobia. So, unfortunately, I think it's going to go in A, but only above Under Construction. It's a great story, a must read. But it's just not as exceptional as Somnophobia, Help Wanted, or Submagnophobia. Unfortunately, that's going to have to be where we wrap up this episode today. But I am happy with where our tier list is at the current moment. Next week, we will finish up the tier list by covering the second half of the Tales and Bellows, so be sure to stay tuned for that. Besides that, thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to stay updated, please consider subscribing, following, or sharing this podcast. It truly helps us broaden our reach. Consider following us on our Twitter, @FazbearPodcast, joining our Discord, or supporting us on Patreon or our merch store using the various links in the description of this episode. As always, I have been your host, Nick Black, and thank you all so much for tuning in. Have a good night, and drive home safe.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.